Welcome to the Talking Legal Ed podcast with Professors Linda Jellum and Billy Joe Kaufman. In each episode, we explore cutting-edge legal issues with renowned legal scholars and teachers. In these explorations, we discuss the legal doctrines implicated in the issues we tackle. But perhaps more importantly, we look at how legal educators can bring these issues alive in the classroom.
Good morning, Billy Joe. I'm excited to see you and get started again with Talking Legal Ed for our third season. I hope you had a great summer.
Did have a great summer, and I think we're going to have an exciting year with Talking Legal Ed.
We've already got a few exciting guests lined up, including our guest today, Professor Matthew Sagg. He is a professor at Emory University School of Law, professor of law in AI. That is a hip place to be right now. And he's going to talk about a new ranking to sort of replace the U.S. News ranking called FLAIR. So I'm anxious to hear what he has to say.
Let's do it.
Okay. Good morning, Matthew. Billy Joe and I are so excited to talk to you about the forward-looking academic impact ratings that you've developed, otherwise known as FLAIR. And we'd like to start by just asking you some questions about what got you into law teaching and what you do in law teaching. So how about that? What is your background with coming into law school teaching?
Well, thanks so much for having me here this morning. I was an intellectual property lawyer. I worked in Australia for a bit less than 2 years. Then I worked in London during the dot-com boom. And then I worked in Silicon Valley for a few years at the sort of tail end of the dot-com boom. And I got into law teaching primarily because my wife wanted to move to Chicago to take an academic job. And I was given the opportunity to be a visiting assistant professor at Northwestern. And you know, it was basically, try this, see if you like it. And I loved it. And here I am.
I get loving it. I think it is the best job in the world. So what classes do you teach? I know you're at Emory now. I think you were at Loyola for a number of years, Loyola in Chicago. And now you're at Emory. So what is it that you teach at Emory?
Right. So right now I teach a copyright course, which is really my main field of study. And I teach a seminar on law and artificial intelligence. And I also teach property as a first year course.
That's a good fit. So let's talk about your scholarship. So, you know, FLAIR is sort of a little out on the side for you. What is your traditional scholarship generally look like?
Yeah. So this is one of the amazing things about having tenure is that you, to get tenure, you have to have this clear, coherent scholarly agenda. And then once you get tenure, you can technically do whatever you want. So most of my scholarship is around law and technology, particularly in copyright. I think the stuff I'm best known for is non-expressive use and how that relates to text data mining and fair use. And this has recently become a pretty big issue with generative AI. I also do some work on the empirical side. I do empirical studies of copyright litigation, IP litigation, and along with Tonya Jacoby, we have a whole series of articles where we do text mining on Supreme Court oral arguments. And so FLAIR has nothing to do with that research agenda, but that research agenda basically gave me the tools that I needed to do FLAIR, right? You know, FLAIR is an empirical project, but it's an empirical project not about the Supreme Court or copyright. It's a project about law schools.
So you kind of were talking a bit over my head there as you were getting into the IP, AI, all that kind of stuff. Tell me how some of these topics, because I know you're a bit of an expert on when one person can use another person's work, for example, to do empirical work without running into copyright issues. How do you bring, and maybe you don't bring this particular thing into the classroom, but how do you bring some of what you were discussing, and particularly with AI and ChatGPT, how do you bring some of that into the classroom with the students?
Given the courses that I teach, the the research that I do is inevitably part of the courses. I mean, the hottest issue in copyright law at the moment is whether it's fair use to train a generative AI model like ChatGPT on other people's copyrighted content. And, you know, that's a subject that, you know, I've had a lot to say about, probably will say more about. And so, you know, inevitably my research and my classroom discussions, you know, are often, you know, there's a sort of fluidity between them. The law and AI seminar I teach, I don't really see how you could teach a seminar like that if you weren't writing in the area, if you weren't reading what's being written, trying to understand what's coming down the pipeline. You know, like there are many different ways to be an effective teacher and to communicate effectively. But I think for me and for a lot of people, being really engaged in the subject matter is, you know, is absolutely vital.
So being both a good teacher and a good scholar is part of the job, is essentially what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, it's not inevitable. You know, we all know some great scholars who are fairly lousy teachers, and we all know some amazing teachers who, for various reasons, just don't really do scholarship or don't do scholarship anymore. But in general, the attributes that make you a good scholar, like curiosity, energy, enthusiasm, staying on top of current events, they're really vital to teaching any course where the law is constantly in flux, which is, you know, most of our law courses.
So talking about curiosity, I am really curious, as someone who's written a lot, both articles and books, what is the answer to AI using my copyrighted material, if there is an answer, or what's the more complicated answer? I'm just curious about that.
I think it's fair to say that that is currently unsettled. My view is that as long as they're just using it for training and the things that the model produces don't really look anything like the training material, then that's a very strong candidate for fair use. So, you know, and I say that not just as a matter of personal opinion, but if we look at all of the cases on analogous copy-reliant technologies, like the Google Book Search case, the HathiTrust case, and even going back into the 1990s, cases on software reverse engineering, that's a pretty clear through line that unites those decisions. But of course, you know, that's just one person's opinion.
I'm pretty excited about talking about FLAIR. First, I've never been particularly a fan of any rankings. I chose my law school when there were no rankings. And my criteria was the law school accredited by the ABA? And I felt that if it met the ABA standards, it must be okay. But then we all got into the world of this ranking. So what prompted your original thinking on this work? It had to be a great asset to have the empirical data background, because some of that must have sent up some red flags to you, I suspect. But can you share that with us?
Yeah. So this project was a long time in the making. One question is, should we have rankings at all? And, you know, if the government was somehow to outlaw it, even though that would obviously violate the First Amendment, I might be okay with that. But the reality is that we're going to have rankings because there's a need in the marketplace for them. America is a big country. No one has firsthand knowledge of every law school in the country, or even like decent firsthand knowledge of all of the law schools that might be relevant to a particular employer or a particular student, no matter how you want to conceive of that student. And so, you know, when we have to make decisions or evaluate You know, what does it mean to look at a student from school A versus school B? We do need some kind of yardstick for making at least a rough comparison. And that's my view. But you know, I wouldn't have started this project if no one had ever done a law school ranking before. Right? This project is very much a response to what I think are really bad law school rankings. You know, I think that the way US News factors in the academic quality of law schools is a joke, right? They ask, you know, they send out a survey to deans of law schools who, I will tell you, are not well informed about the academic quality of other law schools, right? They mostly just know other deans, and to a very haphazard selection of other faculty members, some of whom just throw it in the bin, some of whom answer completely strategically. So, you know, in the Chicago area, I know people who will rank their school five and rank all the other Chicago schools one, even though that's not their personal opinion. And mostly people just don't know. Even, you know, if you're a really well-informed crim pro scholar, you probably know a lot about crim pro people. But that's probably it, right? You probably don't know anything about, oh, who's got a good tax program? Who's got a good IP program? So reputation surveys are just really suspect in terms of validity. But there's another way of doing this, which is to look at academic impact through citation counts. And to me, that makes a huge amount of sense. And a few people have done something like this, but they've always done it in a way that is sort of unnecessarily exclusive. And so there's a ranking that's been out for quite some time now that purports to rank the top third of American law schools, but they actually have no idea who the top third are. They start with a long list of 99. They apply their method to those schools and they generate a ranking within that, but they miss people, you know. And yeah, I'll be honest, you know, one of the reasons why this was salient to me is because I was the associate dean for research at Loyola the last time this ranking came out, and Loyola is not on the list. And I'm like, come on, Loyola has a much better faculty than this school, this school, this school, and this school. And, you know, empirically, like this is just not the way you do it. If you're going to rank American law schools, then you rank them all. Or you at least acknowledge that, hey, we're making an arbitrary selection and this is just a ranking within that arbitrary selection. So FLAIR began basically as an attempt to say, hey, guys, you're doing it wrong. And my initial thought was, how hard could this be? So the ranking that I was responding to, they get their numbers based on Westlaw, and Westlaw is totally fine. The way they query Westlaw, there's not that much wrong with it. It's probably nothing wrong with it, but it's really labor intensive. So in order to figure out how many citations Jane Smith gets, they need to search for Jane Smith and then weed out all the false positives. And not only is that time intensive, but when you have a time intensive, labor intensive process, it definitely tends to introduce errors. Hine Online does the real grunt work for us. Hine Online has citation counts for individual authors at US law schools. All you need to do is download about 190 spreadsheets from Hine Online, add them all together, and then make sure that they've identified the faculty members appropriately.
So it seems to me that you had two issues as you're starting this flare. One, it sounds you wanted to be inclusive of all US law schools, which the other rankings that tried to evaluate impact were not doing. And then number two, so that led to, I would guess, significantly more data than the other rankings had to look at. And your concept of all the spreadsheets you have to look at scares me beyond belief. But then what about identifying who the faculty are?
Yeah. So downloading the spreadsheets was actually the easy part. Identifying the faculty turns out to be the tricky part. And it's both just, it took some work, but it also involves making some very important and ultimately, you know, subjective and contestable decisions. So law schools, most law schools don't have a list on their website that says these are our doctrinal faculty. So to do this, we had to look at like every law school website and figure out what the titles of various people actually meant in terms of whether they were doctrinal faculty at all. We then had to take into account a few other different things. So it's not very fair to judge anyone on their citation count for the last 5 years if they've only been in the job for 5 years, right? It takes time to write some publications, develop a reputation, et cetera. And, you know, obviously the longer you've been out, the more chance you will have had to do that. But I thought it was important to exclude people, you know, early in their careers. Now, you could do that by excluding people pre-tenure, but actually most schools don't clearly identify which of their faculty have tenure and which don't. And also tenure standards vary actually quite a lot between schools. You know, some people go up in 4 years, some people go up in 7 years. In order to have something that I thought was, you know, robust and defensible, you know, I just put a 6-year cut line on it, which meant that I had to, you know, go and find yet another source of data. So there are people online, Sarah Lorsky at Northwestern, who keep track of entry-level hiring every year. I went through the past 6 years of data that she had collected and compared that to my data in order to, you know, weed out the people with 6 years or less experience. And all of those steps, I mean, they're fairly simple if you do them for one faculty. You do them for 190 odd faculties, it takes a fair bit of work. Now,
let me ask you one question, if you don't mind. Let me ask you one question, because if you're categorizing faculty who would be expected to have writings and citations, let's take something that occurs at Mercer, which is different at where I am now, which is Idaho. But at Mercer, our writing faculty, the faculty who teach the writing classes, are full-time standard doctrinal faculty. In other schools, they're not. So what do you do with that situation?
So I thought it was very important, one, just to have a very clear definition of who was in and who was out. And in that definition, to make sure that schools wouldn't be punished for improving the quality of their education. So if a school hires an additional full-time legal writing instructor, it would seem perverse that even if that person didn't publish law review articles, that would affect their, you know, average citations. In most schools, legal writing and clinical faculty and professors of practice are not expected to produce scholarship. Now, many of them do, but it is not usually the basis upon which they are hired. It's not usually the basis of their annual reviews. It's not usually the basis of the decision of whether or not they get promoted. And so, you know, it's a politically sensitive thing, because I wanted to make it clear in the paper that I'm not saying these people aren't valuable members of the school. I'm not saying that their scholarship isn't valuable. You know, I've worked with a number of clinicians over the years. I've co-written an article in Nature with a clinician and an amicus brief with a clinician. So I know, you know, that there's no difference. But there's a huge difference in terms of the expectation. And I think, you know, when you have to rule a line somewhere, that's where to rule the line. So yeah, the definition of the faculty that I use might seem like a little conservative, but I think, you know, given what we're doing here is trying to say, you know, what is the average scholarly impact of the doctrinal faculty at that at a particular school, that sort of conservative definition makes sense.
So what were the major surprises you found when you went through all the data, figured out, and you ranked in groups, like, you know, sort of a top 10 and a next 10 or whatever. I can't remember how many you had per group, but what were the surprises when you completed your research?
Well, I'll tell you what wasn't a surprise. What wasn't a surprise is that Loyola and many other schools that had been previously shut out of the other survey, you know, which I shall not name, turned out to be well within the top third, right? That's not a surprise. Also not a surprise that many of the schools that I looked at in the supposed top third list, again, I'm not going to name them individually on the podcast. And I thought, really? Who's at that school? I don't know anyone there. Some of them fell like way out of the top third. So that's what was not surprising to me. What I think is interesting is when you look at the top tier, that the top tier is not the US News T14. You know, first of all, I think one of the really strong advantages about looking at everyone and asking, you know, how would I present this at an empirical conference rather than to sell newspapers, right? To sell newspapers or to sell advertising space online, you want to emphasize the horse race. You want to say, oh, Northwestern dropped from 12th to 13th, or, you know, Cornell went from, I don't know, 13th to 9th. Like, isn't that amazing? Isn't this sensational? What's going on at those universities? Well, the answer, nothing's going on at those universities. Those are stupid, meaningless differences, right? The differences that matter are, you know, the differences between different tiers. So I calculate the tiers just basically looking at the average and looking at the standard deviation above and below the average. And I think the top tier is every school more than one standard deviation above the average. And that turns out to be a top 21, maybe 22. It's definitely not the T14. And in that list, you'll see some schools that never get a look in at the T14. But actually, when you think about it and you look at who's at those schools, you're like, oh, yeah, that's a really good faculty. So, you know, UC Irvine comes to mind as an example. So I think it's not a surprise to me, but one of the things that might be a surprise to people is just how much difference there is between this and the US News rankings that, regrettably, I think we've all internalized to some extent. I had a colleague ask me, oh, should I accept an offer from school A or school B to publish this paper? You know, US News ranks them the same. And I'm like, so, like, and I've got to admit, I've done exactly the same thing. So I think one thing that comes out of this paper is it gives people something else to look at when they know that US News is mostly ridiculous. You know,
Matt, can I ask a question? Because I think US News always tries to sell this virtue of giving the law student consumer information and data points to make choices about where they might go to law school. And your work, I'm not sure, would be understandable to any incoming 1L or student applying saying, oh, well, you know, this faculty is writing more than that faculty. I'm not sure they even understand we do that. So it sounds like your product is a more sophisticated product for even what you just mentioned, a person who's got a law review article and they're trying to choose between school A or B. How do you see flair in the marketplace.
Maybe that's right. But I am hopeful that the notion of what the different tiers of law school are in terms of academic impact, because that's not everything that goes into a law school by any stretch of the imagination. But for students who think that they care about academic impact or academic prestige, this provides them with a way of saying, oh, right, I'm thinking between Georgetown and Georgia, right? Like, is it obvious that I should take Georgetown? No, actually, it's not obvious at all. These schools are comparable. Are there differences between Georgetown and Georgia? Well, yeah, there are a ton of differences, and the student should go make their decision based on those differences, right? On the fact that one's in Washington, D.C., one's in a much smaller city in the state of Georgia.
Athens,
one's a
Georgia.
State school, right? It's going to have lower tuition probably. In some ways, I think that this will be a useful tool to free people up from feeling like, oh, if I don't just maximize on the US news rankings, then I'm really doing myself a disservice. Because we all know that's not true. We all know that in general, what students get out of law school is going to be a function of what they put into it. And that there are a lot of places that are really different and offer different opportunities. But those differences are not the differences in ranking between 37 and 48 in US News.
So were you able to make use of research assistants, or did you talk about this work in your classes at all?
Yeah. So I used a very large room of research assistants for one day at Emory to do some quality control on the data on the faculty lists. Most of the work was done by me and a research assistant who wrote a ton of Python code, right? A lot of the drudge work that I've described was still a reasonable amount of drudgery, but it was a great deal of it was scripted. So, my research assistant who did all the Python work, he scraped all the websites to get all the faculty lists. I then used a different software program to start categorizing faculty in terms of their titles. And, the titles are slightly different at different universities, but after a while there are patterns and, if I'd done all of this manually, even with the team of research assistants, it never would have got done. And so that's where doing some prior empirical work was quite helpful, because I was able to look at this problem and understand, well, that looks really daunting, but actually, these parts can be outsourced and these parts can be automated. But yeah, it still actually turned out to be a lot more work than I thought it would be.
Well, so maybe the answer to bringing into the classroom is you haven't yet, but maybe in the future. But let me ask you, what does this mean going forward? Is this a one-off? You've done it one time and now we're done. Are you going to be updating this? I know that your article with Flair is coming out in the Florida State University Law Review. I don't think it's published yet, but pending. Is it available on SSRN if people wanted to take a look at your earlier drafts?
Yes. Okay. So the article is up on SSRN, and it will be coming out in the Florida State Law Review sometime this year.
So what happens next year?
Next year, I do it all again, but smarter and more efficiently now that I know how it was done. And also being able to compare against this year's data will save me a lot of time, because I'll basically only have to look at what's changed. But I've been thinking about this for the past few days, and it's still it's still going to be a lot of work. But I think it's important. And I say that because you have got a lot of emails from faculty all around the country saying more or less, thanks for doing this. I always hated the way we were just left out. Like people just ignored us, like we didn't matter, you know? And I think, I just have a deep sense that that's wrong. I think everyone matters, you know? I run marathons, like not very fast, right? The great thing about the Chicago Marathon is you run the same race as the world champion. You run the same race as the best runners in the world. You run with 35, 40,000 other people. And even though some will run faster than others, everyone counts, right? Everyone gets a time. If you finish, you get a time. No one looks at you and says, you're too old, you're too slow, we're not even going to bother timing your efforts, your achievements. And I think that's the way it should be.
So assuming that we agree with you, which I think we both do, one of the questions is going to be, I mean, this first flare is going in the Florida State Law Review. Obviously, you're not going to continuously publish in a law review every year. Maybe you will. Maybe the Florida State has an online place, but have you located a home, maybe on Emory's web somewhere or on your own personal one, or are you just going to use SSRN? I mean, this needs to get out there if it's going to have an impact. How are you going to make sure that the world knows about it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I should probably set up its own website, but we'll have to see how that goes. As I've said, like, this is not my main scholarly activity. And, you know, I will definitely, you know, at least just post a version to SSRN and release it on, you know, Law Prof blog and things like that. You know, I don't plan on writing a law review article about this every year. Like, there's not much more to be said other than here's the methodology, here's why it's important. But I do think, you know, it's important and useful to update it because, you know, One of the points here is things change. Like, you know, people leave, people become more impactful, people become less impactful. Like those changes should matter somewhere. And at the moment, all we've got is kind of like a gossipy way of like listing, oh, you know, who moved where and, you know, whether so-and-so thinks that was like a good hire or not. And you know, that's just not my style. I like things to be a little bit more objective.
It occurs to me it could be, depending on the work, something like the Washington and Lee website, which people have just learned to go to for whatever reason they're going. So maybe a Flair website, just with the updated data each time, and then, you know, the five highlights or the surprises each year, or wonder what caused that, could be pretty interesting because there will be, you know, I just realized, I think it was Boston College, you know, just hired 16 new faculty. It's like, wow, those numbers are incredible, right? And so that school's, there's going to be a change of some sort. Now, I'm sure they lost some to retirements and moving on to other schools, but those big differences would be interesting to share in some way to the community.
Yeah, no, I think looking at the big year-on-year differences, and Boston College is definitely one of these schools that in the current FLAIR rankings, their performance is well below the U.S. News ranking.
And so, it may be Boston University that made those big hires. So,
but no, I'm pretty sure Boston College has hired a bunch of people.
I just remember I thought 16 was bigger than we were. So,
yeah. I mean, Emory just hired 10 people last year. So, yeah, there's a lot of change, and I think that's. That's good. And it's another reason why, you know, maybe we shouldn't just be relying on reputation that is really just based on the reputation the year before that and so on.
So before we leave, we're getting close to the end of our time. I think we sort of omitted a discussion that we probably should have had. And one is the difference between impact citations and merit, because they're very different. And it's, I think, one of the criticisms maybe that Flair has received. And then also the concept that sometimes citations tend to be gendered or, you know, based on somebody being a white male, for example, might have more citations than, let's say, an African-American female. So what do you want to tell me about those, impact versus merit and the potential bias that's in this, that's unavoidable in what you're doing?
So this is a really important topic, and I'm so grateful that you brought it up. And it's something that I've had a lot of discussions with people for the past 2 years about this issue. One of the things that I think is really important to understand is there's a difference between biased data and data that reflects bias in society. So, you know, and that gets to my point about there's a difference between impact and merit, right? There are people who are kind of overrated and oversighted. You know, they're like the privileged white male at a high status university, who's just been around a little bit longer than everyone else. And, you know, they have an academic impact that I personally subjectively think is not entirely merited, right? There are people who are, you know, not at the right school, don't have the right letterhead, or just don't go to conferences and network effectively, or for whatever reason, their work is good, but it doesn't get cited. It doesn't have the same impact. And, you know, I regret that fact, but that's the world we live in. And so, you know, Flair is not going to do very much at all to resolve those underlying inequalities. And, you know, absolutely, I'm sure there are gender issues in citations, perhaps not at the citation end, but about how work is distributed in faculties, how work is distributed in the home, about expectations, all those things. And so, yeah, I want to be clear, like, this is not about the merit of faculties. Like, this is about the current academic impact. And some of that impact, a lot of that impact will be a result of what we loosely think of as merit. And then some of it won't, right? There's, you know, but, you know, I think, you know, as long as we're clear what we're looking at, which is impact, not merit. And we're also clear that a lot of the objections that you might have about looking at citation counts for individuals just fall away when you aggregate that data into faculties, right? Every faculty has, you know, a historian who writes books. Well, yeah, they're not going to have very good Hine Online numbers because Hine Online is about law reviews, right? Some faculties have your person who's a genius, but they write about Icelandic legal theory and no one cares about that, right? But, you know, most faculties are a kind of a balance. And so when you add the whole faculty together and you look at the mean and the median, those differences mostly come out in the wash. So I would be, you know, I don't want people to use like one source of citation data to evaluate like new faculty hires. You know, you should look at Westlaw, you should look at Google, you should read the work. If you're trying to evaluate individual faculty, you should look at a bunch of different sources. You should look at Google, you should look at Westlaw, and most importantly, you should read the work.
Perfect. As we end, Matt, what do you hope the legacy of Flair will be? What do you hope to change in the world with this article?
I really hope that people stop talking about US News so much. But when they do, they say, well, yeah, US News says this, but, you know, the Flair rankings say this. And, you know, and hopefully other sources will come along to sort of say something more meaningful about, you know, what the quality of students is, and those things can all be grouped together. So, you know, one, I want to take away the mental real estate that US News has in all of our heads. And two, I hope that the other measures of citation impact that I'm responding to, I would like them to do what I've done. I would like them to give everyone a fair shot.
Seems like a fair ask. Well, Billy Jo and I have been so glad to have you on the show and so glad to learn about FLIR. I will say I, of course, looked up my current and my prior institution to see where they fell in the rankings, which was very interesting. I'm proud to say my current institution is significantly higher than its U.S. News and World rankings would suggest. So I, for one, am wholeheartedly in favor of FLIR. And maybe it will encourage even more scholarly production among faculties, because now it's maybe going to be seen, as you said, everybody will be seen. Billy Jo, any last words?
I do, because Matt has really got me thinking of where the law libraries and the associate deans for faculty support and where does that institution support for scholarship play in a FLIR ranking. So maybe there's a librarian's article out there that could be a companion piece with the FLIR rankings that would show something more than how many books we have on the shelf. so there might be a FLIR redux or something going forward, because I think all of those things make a big difference in how faculty and even particularly tenure track faculty take advantage of those services. So thank you very much.
Yeah, scholarship leading to more scholarship, which is what it usually happens. Well, thanks again, Matt. We will try to figure out how to get a link up on our show notes to your article when you link it up on SSRN. So if you want to send that to me when you have a chance, have a great day. And we have really enjoyed the conversation.
Great. Well, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much for listening. We look forward to speaking with you again in our next episode of Talking Legal Ed.
Talking Legal Ed is produced by David Ritchie in association with Panopticon Media. Editing by Tim Spieshock and artwork by Kaylee Jellum. Please look for all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts.